som marchon. Let's undo it. If not to heaven, together to hell, hand in hand to hell. Freedom means the freedom to go to hell. It's my choice whether I want to go to hell or heaven. The hell of my choice is heaven. And the heaven that is imposed on me by another is prison. It's hell. That's what Milton wants to convey in his Paradise Lost, he seems to have glorified Satan. So we in this country today have the freedom to go to hell if we like, but let us go to hell hand in hand. Because if we want to go to hell personally, singly, the way to hell is paved with good intentions. This togetherness is the first necessity of social life, and togetherness means sharing weal and woe, not only material goods, but sharing weal and woe. This is not distribution is an entirely different thing. It's not the same thing as sharing. And revolution does not strive for distribution, not even equitable distribution, but sharing. And in sharing, the basis of distribution is love, brotherhood, fraternity. So it's a familistic, fraternal social order for which this revolution ought to work. And who will be the architect of this revolution? The man who most needs it. But the difficulty is that the man who most needs a change in the social order does not seek it. The necessity is there, but it seems that the desire is not there. Because his mind has been conditioned in the present social order by politicians, by educationists, and by religion. Why does the poor man bear the burden of his property? He suffers the pangs of poverty because he hopes to become rich someday. So this hope sustains him in his poverty, in his penury, if you like. And why does the rich man bear the burden of his riches? Friends, it's not in the nature of man to possess. Man wants use, not possession. Possession is a liability. If he had the assurance that he could get a thing whenever he wants it, he wouldn't store. He stores because there is insecurity for the morrow. So he provides for a rainy day, and every day is a rainy day because there is no assurance. So psychologically, fundamentally, the poor man and the rich man have the same mind. The rich man is afraid of becoming poor, and the poor man hopes to become rich. That is why both cooperate in maintaining the present social order. Friends, the rich man is not a different species. He was also once poor. Just as every saint has a past and every sinner a future, every rich man has had a past and every poor man has a future. Therefore, when we say that if we eliminate the rich man, poverty could be eliminated, we are laboring under a serious delusion. This is a delusion. Because the rich man doesn't belong to a separate race. You can become rich and he can become poor. So he belongs to the same species as we do. This is what I call faith, or in Sanskrit you may call it astikata. Faith in the goodness of man. Goodness of every man, because goodness is man's nature. Wickedness requires a reason. Yesterday, an auto rickshaw driver, fell into a ditch. The neighbors didn't know him, but they ran spontaneously. That is human. This is human nature. But if someone had said, this man is a Pakistani or a Chinese, perhaps no one would have cared to help him. So indifference or enmity requires a reason. While your heart naturally goes out to an ailing man. So the man who is in misery, who has been living in conditions that are abominable, must inspire spontaneous sympathy in our hearts. So this revolution is trying to find out, is in quest of a technique that will be effective as well as human, that will be in consonance with our end. The end in view is all advances approach. Every step in this revolution must bring men nearer to each other. In a democracy, your opponent is not your antagonist. Just as in a game, say of cricket or of cards, your opponent is your playmate on the other side. The playmate on the other side is not your adversary. He is a part of the game. When I was in jail, I didn't know what playing bridge means. And we were only four in the same cell. So I was compelled every day to sit on the opposite side as a dummy, because the play could not be complete without opposition. That's the role of the opposition in a democracy. These are not armies engaged in a civil war. There must be fundamental mutual faith. Otherwise they couldn't be part of the game. And mutual goodwill. A sense of honor. They are not fighting a battle, but engaged in playing a game which is very serious. Play is perhaps the most spiritual thing in our life, if it is real play and not commercialized, not a profession. But there is a serious contradiction in our present democratic setup. The candidate belongs to a party, but the representative is a representative of the people. It's the voter who has elected him. But the party can order him out. So I always held that the party is a conspiracy against the people. We want a voters' democracy and not a democracy of candidates. Candidates are of concern not with public opinion, not with awakening public opinion, but in gathering votes. Pickwick was once asked by his friend Snodgrass a very difficult question: how to act when in doubt? Pickwick was a quick-witted fellow and could answer any question offhand. So he said, when in doubt, follow the mob. But that didn't solve the question. That solved the problem. So Snodgrass asks, and what if there be two mobs? Follow the largest. That was Pickwick's prescription. But there is a world of difference between a mob and the people or the public. What is a mob? A faceless, amorphous blob of population. So it's not neither public nor the people. The people are an entirely different category. What is a mob? A mob is a congregation of men, a collection of men which has several heads but no brain. Several breasts but no heart. The people have consciousness, a purpose. They gather together for a certain purpose. So democracy is not crassy of the crowd, neither is it my crassy. As the Orthodox people always said, orthodoxy is my doxy, heterodoxy is your doxy. Democracy is my crassy and autocracy is your crassy. That is the level on which our politics has been working for the last few years, for the last several years, you might say. So we have to change the very basis of our political system. This system of democracy. Democracy of the candidate, well, is an auction both of democracy, the candidate and his voter. It was perhaps Edmund Burke, if I remember right, who said, leaders are bidders at an auction of popularity. So in the capitalist context, even democracy will be auctioned. And gods will be auctioned, men will be auctioned. That is why we want to change this context. Revolution has three dimensions: change of context, change of values, and change of heart. We want to change this context because in the context of commercialism and capitalism, every blessed thing becomes a commodity. It is either purchased or sold, including man and his God. So we want to liberate man from this context. And what man? Who? Not we. It's not we who will liberate him, but it's the last man who needs a revolution, a social change, will liberate himself. Now what's the distinction between the man who needs change and the man who does not need change? I shall just analyze this more or less in a symbolic manner, so that I may not be required to keep you very long and try your patience. There is the man with the sword, who enjoys a status in the present society. There is the man with the purse, with his coffers, who also enjoys considerable social status because he can purchase everything. he can purchase even democracy. And then there is the man of power. Power is the most dangerous of all these intoxicants. The man in power is tipsy most of the time. So we have to liberate the man who has neither sword, nor purse, nor power in his hand. Then what has he in his hand? He has the means and instruments of production. But we have always conditioned him into the false notion that power rests with the sword, the purse, and the state. As a matter of fact, they are all been created by men. A breath can make them as a breath has made. Goldsmith sang. Who made the sword? Who made the purse? And who made the throne on which the king sits? It's the man with the implements, tools, who has made all these symbols of social status and social prestige as well as social power. I was once on a tour and was expected to reach a city for a public meeting scheduled to be held in the evening. I asked a friend to lend me his car. But since I am not a very important leader or a man in power, he lent me his ramshackle jeep. On the way, the rod of the jeep gave way, and I was stranded. I was at a loss what to do. Someone suggested that there was a village very near, hard by, very near. So we pushed the jeep to the village. There was the village smith under his tree, plowing his bellows. I asked him whether he could help us. He said he could certainly. So he mended the rod and he said, "You could go to the city." I said, "That's as much as we want. What will you have us pay?" He asked for 1 rupee. 1 rupee meant a great deal in those days. I paid him 2 rupees. He began to weep. I asked him, "Have I hurt you?" "No," he said, "these are tears of joy." "But why do you weep? Have you never been working the whole day?" He said, "I have been working the whole day, but did not get a paise for my work." "Why?" He said, "The first man who came was the head of the village. So no one expects him to pay. The other man who came was the village patwari. And the third man who came was the Mahajan, whom I owe some rupees. And the last man, the last customer who came, was the policeman. What did he ask you to do? He asked me to whet the edge of his bayonet. I did it faithfully, sincerely. Why didn't you ask him for payment? He said, I asked. But he wouldn't pay. Why didn't you argue with him? He said, I dare not argue. He threatened. And what did he threaten you with? He said, I'll cut your throat if you argue with me. And with what would he have cut your throat? With his bayonet. Who made the bayonet? I made the bayonet. So it's the man with the implements and tools who forges the instruments of his exploitation and suppression. Friends, this is revolutionary trade unionism. Organize labor on this basis, and they will realize that the real strength is rests with them, not with the soldier or the capitalist or the man in power. This is the social revolutionary consciousness that we have to rouse among the common people. We have been deceiving them, cheating them into believing that real power is not in the instruments of production, but in the instruments of exploitation and destruction. What's the difference between an implement and a weapon? If I were to use a sword to cut a cucumber, you would all ridicule me. You will say, the poor man doesn't know what a sword is for. His forefathers have never used it, never wielded a sword. So how does he know the proper use of a sword? The proper use of a weapon is to take life. It's to destroy life. The proper use of the sword is to kill. And if you use it for production, you are misusing it. To use the sword for any other purpose is to misuse the sword. But the hammer and sickle, if you use them for destroying life, you are misusing them. They have been designed to produce life-giving material goods. So the real power, the ultimate power, is with the man who has the implements in his hand and not the armaments. As I said, this is not a question of violence or non-violence. If you reduce a social virtue into an abstract theory or principle, it loses its essence. it ceases to have any bearing on real life. This has happened to me in actual life. Once I was addressing a meeting at Pathankot, and a sturdy Sardar was the chairman. He began the meeting, "Hinduo Binduo, Muslimo Chuslimo, Sikho Mikho." That's an impolite way of addressing. "Keep peace in this meeting. Don't utter a word. Otherwise, you see, I have this cudgel in my hand." And after this said, "I now request Dada Dharmadhikari to address us on non-violence." That's the milieu which we create when we reduce a virtue, a social value, to a creed. That is why there have been more wars in the name of religion and God than in the name of kingdoms and property. Spiritual values are quite different from religious values or ethical values that are reduced to a concept and a principle. So I have given you some idea of the new context that we want to create, because new values will require a new context. And who will bring about this revolution? The man who has translated revolutionary values into his life. Once I was addressing a huge meeting, a mass meeting of students at Patna. And they said, "Well, what do you expect us to sacrifice? We have no property. We can't sacrifice. We have no money. So we can't give you any donations. We are merely students at college. So what's the actual program, the code of conduct that you could prescribe for us?" When Jayaprakash was a red hot socialist, he said, "Socialism is not an individual code of conduct." Gandhi replied by saying, "To me, every revolution begins with a code of individual conduct. Charity begins at home." So they asked me what they could do. I said, "I can advise you about one thing. I can point out definitely to one thing that you can do. And that is, today you write to your father that you relinquish all claim on his property. Because you don't believe in hereditary property. Private, not only private property, but hereditary property. So you can relinquish your right to the property of your father." The secretary of that meeting came and whispered in my ear, "It seems we have invited a wrong man." Because they want to do anything except translating revolutionary values into their whole own life. So this is change of heart. And this change of heart has to begin with the revolutionary himself. I shall conclude this talk today with the hope that you and I and all of us will realize that the maker of history in the future will be the man with the plowshare and not the man with the sword. So far, human history has been made by kings, warriors, heroes, and politicians. We are looking forward to a day when history will be made by the common man. He will no longer be the subject of history, but the architect of history. History has not ceased. Time has not stopped. And there is no last word in history. There is no last event in history. Every event that is recorded in history is not repetitive. Every event is unprecedented. So let us not ask ourselves whether this has happened anywhere else. If it has not happened anywhere else, it should happen in India simply because it has not happened anywhere else. That's the spirit in which we have to address ourselves to this task, to this romantic adventure of a total revolution. Thank you. This is the last of the three talks that I have been asked to give. I wonder if I have been able to convey adequately what I wanted to convey to this audience. Inquiring, who will make this revolution? Who will be its central figure, its hero? And yesterday we came to the conclusion that it will be the plowman and not the soldier. The citizen as plowman, because we are living in a country which is mainly agrarian. And in an agrarian country, the revolution must not only benefit the peasant, the man who tills the land, but it should also be mainly brought about by his effort. So it will be not a revolution for the people, but a revolution by the people, in which the common man will be able actively to participate. He will not be a passive participant or a sleeping partner. And not only the common man, but also the common woman. Women should be able to take as active a part in this revolution, as active a part as men. This means that we will have to explore an entirely new technique of revolution. So we have to think of revolution in the technique of revolution. And the first condition is that there should be no necessity for a counter-revolution of any type. A revolution which will leave no room or no need for a counter-revolution. That is what a total revolution means. We have had revolutions in the world, two in the last century, one in America, the other in France, and two in this century, the one in Russia and the latest in China. These have been called Marxist revolutions. I shall not dispute that claim because I do not claim to be a very well acquainted student with Marxism